It is the Lake Show. Steve in for Henry tonight. He's back tomorrow night to close out another week here in early January. Chris Tubbs, our producer, alongside through 9 o'clock tonight. Highlights of all our shows available online at WCCRadio.com. All available in podcast form. And we're thrilled when you download those and listen to those later or whenever it is convenient. And, of course, you can get all of that on the free Odyssey app. Right now, we're pleased to be joined by Stephen Clark from Ars Technica. I've been visiting with Stephen now for a number of years about space flight on the program. Stephen, good to visit with you. And it's been a while, so it's not too late to say Happy New Year.
Same to you, Steve. Always a pleasure to chat.
A lot going on. Let's get into and now a couple of billionaires are at the forefront of space flight. Of course, Elon Musk and SpaceX. He is certainly very involved in politics at the moment. And then you have Jeff Bezos of Amazon fame, who also has his own company building rockets, etc. And it looks as though we're coming up rapidly on what could be the first flight of a big new rocket from his company.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. The New Glenn rocket, named after the former astronaut and Senator John Glenn, is set to launch for the first time this weekend, Saturday night. In fact, if the final preparations all go according to plan and the weather cooperates. And this is long awaited. Jeff Bezos founded Blue Origin back in 2000, so the company's 25 years old. They've launched a number of flights of a smaller rocket they call the New Shepard. That's like a space tourist vehicle. In fact, Jeff Bezos and his brother flew on that to the edge of space back in 2021. And a number of people, paying customers, and some celebrities, actually, including William Shatner, have flown on that vehicle to space and back, again, just going up and down in about a 10-minute flight. New Glenn is a different animal altogether. It is an enormous rocket. It's over 300 feet tall. It's somewhere in between the scale of a Falcon 9 rocket, which is SpaceX's workhorse, and the Starship, which we've talked about many times before, which is Elon Musk's enormous new rocket that's in the test phase down in South Texas. New Glenn kind of comes in between those. A lot of companies, including SpaceX, when they launch their first orbital rocket, they start small. SpaceX started with a very small rocket with just one engine, capable of putting maybe a half ton of payload in orbit, or even less than that. Blue Origin and Jeff Bezos' team are going big from the start with the New Glenn rocket. It is an enormous rocket, as I mentioned. It can carry somewhere on the order of 45 tons to orbit of payload, and they're going to try to recover the booster stage. They're going to try to land it on their own barge. We've seen SpaceX do this hundreds of times now over the last 10 years or so, and Blue Origin is going to try to replicate that, and if they do, they'll be the second company to ever accomplish that feat. And, you know, in my view, this is, you know, it would be fantastic for spaceflight if this rocket works and they're able to recover it and get reuse, and accomplish reuse this year, perhaps on a subsequent mission this year. And this would really greatly expand the capability of the United States in terms of access to space to have two companies with big reusable rockets.
And Stephen, by the way, Stephen Clark from Ars Technica joining us on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. What is the market for this, or would they be in a lot of spaces a competitor to what SpaceX is doing right now? A lot of commercial customers, potentially the U.S. government, etc.
Very much a potential competitor to SpaceX. And, of course, there are other companies out there that launch rockets from the United States. United Launch Alliance is one of those. That's kind of the longtime incumbent. They have heritage back to the 1950s between Lockheed Martin and Boeing. But they're not working seriously on a reusable booster for their rocket. And there are other startups as well that are in very much earlier phases of development of their rockets. But New Glenn is real. It's on the launch pad. It's about to fly in a few days' time. And, yeah, it's going to be a direct competitor to Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy. Maybe not so much Starship. It's not quite of the scale of Starship. But it could certainly launch big satellites for the military, for big missions for NASA, robotic missions for NASA. And it's going to be launching the Kuiper satellites. The Amazon is coming out with their own internet network to rival Starlink, and many of those satellites will also be launching on Blue Origin's New Glenn.
And now, could there be human missions on this rocket? Is that part of the plan?
Eventually, yes. That is part of the roadmap that Jeff Bezos has for the, for his space company, Blue Origin. They haven't said a lot about that, but they are kind of hinting at that. They are dropping breadcrumbs for those of us who are outside the company trying to figure out what they're doing. That's certainly a goal for Blue Origin, is to develop a crew capsule that could launch on the New Glenn rocket into space with people into orbit. And in fact, another use for New Glenn down the road will be as it will be launching a lander to the moon for NASA, first robotically and then people. And that is something SpaceX is already on contract to do as well. So NASA has a contract with SpaceX to build a version of the Starship rocket to land people on the moon for the Artemis program, potentially later this decade. And they awarded that contract to SpaceX, and then they came back and decided they wanted a second provider to provide assurances. And you know, if one company runs into trouble, they have a backup. This proved very, very, a very smart move with SpaceX and Boeing with their crew capsule program that we've talked about with Starliner. You know, it's still not certified for spaceflight, and SpaceX has been flying people to the space station for years now. So having these two providers has proven very useful and a smart move for NASA before, and NASA now has SpaceX and Blue Origin on contract for the next big thing, which is landing people on the moon.
Yeah, and it's got to make you wonder, and I have brought this up before, and I've talked to other people who follow space flight and write about space flight regularly, that if New Glenn, for instance, is a success and they start moving forward and Starship continues to have success and they check things off and continue to reach milestones, etc., I would assume it's going to be very difficult for the new administration, which by the way, it appears Elon Musk has some influence with the new administration, that they would continue to fund the Artemis program, considering that gigantic rocket is 100% disposable, very expensive, that we could see a rapid change of course at some point in the fairly near future.
I think that's likely. I would put it more than 50-50 odds on that, Steve. I think that is likely to happen within, you know, I'm not sure it's going to be President Trump's first priority on day one, but sure. I think this year there could be major changes coming for the Artemis program, up to and including the cancellation of the Space Launch System, whether it flies one or two more times or is cut immediately, I think it's still undecided, but I would not be surprised at all if the Trump administration axes the Space Launch System. They may keep the Orion spacecraft for the interim. It could launch on a number of different rockets, potentially, including the Falcon Heavy or New Glenn, or even ULA's launches Vulcan rocket, potentially. So they have options to launch that capsule. And I think the reason they would want to keep that for a number of years, a few years at least, is because it's had its problems with its heat shield, but it's the only spacecraft, in my estimation, in the next 4 or 5 years that could bring astronauts back from the moon at that high velocity that they're going to be coming back through the atmosphere and reentering for splashdown. It has to have a really, really robust heat shield for that. And I think the Orion spacecraft with its heat shield is really the only vehicle that is on the near-term horizon that could do that in the next few years, because Donald Trump and Elon have talked about the wanting to land people on the moon by the end of his term. So that is 4 years, and the clock is ticking. And really, if I was a betting person, I think the Orion spacecraft gives them the best chance. But, you know, we'll see what the administration decides.
Yeah. And once again, stay tuned to that, because there are a lot of players and a lot of well-heeled players in this space for sure. And speaking of that, we'll get into the next test flight of Starship. And this is new and improved. They're constantly making improvements and innovations. And we'll get into that with Stephen in a moment. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. Stephen Clark from Ars Technica. You can read his work at arstechnica.com/space here in News Talk 830-WCCO. It is indeed the Lake Show. Henry has the night off. Steve Thompson in. Typically in on Saturdays between 3 and 6. Fill in for Henry from time to time. And oh, by the way, I'll be filling in on the huddle this Sunday morning between 10 and noon. Pete Najarian, yours truly, Dave Schwartz, has the day off. I'll look forward to the huddle this Sunday between 10 and noon. We continue with Stephen Clark from Ars Technica. And Stephen, Starship ready to launch. And it's extraordinary what we've seen from the very early stages when they were kind of taking these short hops with prototypes to full-blown launch recovery efforts. The fact that in one of these test launches, they were able to bring back the gigantic super heavy booster back to the pad and catch it with chopstick arms. I think people really anticipate these flights, and this will be an upgraded version of Starship, won't it?
Yes, it will, Steve. This is version 2 of Starship, and it's a little bit taller. It's about 6 feet or so taller than the previous iteration, so not that much significantly larger, but it will break the record and break SpaceX's own record for the largest rocket ever built when it flies next week, potentially. And this version 2 Starship comes with many upgrades. One of them is an improved computer system, improved propellant plumbing inside the spacecraft to feed propellants down to the engines, and larger fuel tanks. That's one of the big changes, is it can carry 25% more propellant, methane and liquid oxygen. That means it can carry heavier payloads into space. And in fact, on this mission, one of the firsts will be that they will exercise and try to test the satellite deployment mechanism on Starship. So on future flights, when Starship goes into orbit, it can deploy satellites of various types. In fact, the deployment system that they're going to use has been likened to a PEZ dispenser. They stack satellites inside the tube of the payload compartment and just pop them out one after the other. And on this mission, they're carrying 10 dummy satellites that are sized to replicate Starlink satellites, because on future Starship flights, SpaceX wants to start deploying Starlink satellites, because they can carry much bigger satellites, many more satellites than the Falcon 9 is launching today.
Yeah, and certainly generating income from launching satellites, not only for their low-level satellite network that provides internet service, and I would assume eventually phone service to all over the globe will be available, is a big part of it. But another part of this system, and that is eventually helping get humans back to the moon and beyond. And there's a lot of capabilities that need to be proven. Once again, once ship reaches orbit, can it go on orbit, maneuver in orbit, and then ultimately return? Because so far, they haven't made a full orbit and continuing to test the heat shields. We have seen progress, though, on each one of these flights.
Yes, we have. Each flight has accomplished more than the previous flight. There have been no major setbacks on any of these flights. And so it does raise the expectation level each time. Rockets are finicky. They're very complex. So that things can go wrong. We've seen failures on very mature, very experienced programs before. So I don't want to, I'm knocking on wood here, but I do expect SpaceX to have another successful test flight next week. And we've seen them catch the booster. One of the next things they want to try, not on this flight, but if everything goes well on this flight, potentially on the following flight, which I would wager will be just in a couple of months' time at most, they want to actually catch the ship, the upper stage, back on the launch site, just like they did the booster. And to do that, you have to put the ship into orbit. It has to complete at least one full lap around the planet and come back over the United States and ultimately Mexico and the United States and ultimately land back in Texas where it launched from. These early test flights, including the one next week, are on what we call suborbital trajectories, meaning they don't quite, they intentionally don't quite attain the speed they need to reach a stable orbit. So Earth's gravity pulls the ship back down naturally and it will target a controlled splashdown in the Indian Ocean. They've done that three times in a row now very successfully. They're going to try it again with this upgraded ship this time. And if it goes well, potentially they could have the confidence they need to go for a longer flight. You know, the flight will to come back around to Texas will last a couple of hours at least, maybe longer if they do more than one orbit, whereas these early flights have lasted about an hour. So they need more endurance on the ship, and these upgrades that they're going to test next week are part of that.
Couple of things beyond that. Once they accomplish those goals and continue to prove the reusability of the system, ultimately, to get humans to the moon and beyond, they will ultimately need to get fuel into orbit and store that fuel in orbit to be able to fuel flights to the moon or beyond that to Mars. And that's really the next gigantic step, to prove that capability. And the sense is that there's a lot of work to be done there.
There really is. And I think crucial to all of this is for SpaceX to really ramp up their flight cadence. You know, they've done seven flights now in a little under 2 years, if you count the one next week. And this year they are about to get FAA approval to go for 25 flights this year. And I think that with the new administration, with you mentioned Elon Musk having the new president's ear and some influence there, I wouldn't be surprised if some of those regulatory hurdles lower somewhat this year. And I think once that happens, if it does happen, the onus is really going to be on SpaceX to produce these vehicles, fly them, and hopefully catch them, and reuse them. And, you know, because that means you have to build fewer engines, fewer vehicles. It really doesn't just reduce the cost. It really allows you to launch more often than if you had to build a new vehicle every time. So I think that's fundamental to all of this. And only then does the propellant refueling become possible, really, because to send a Starship to the moon or Mars, as NASA and SpaceX are discussing, you need to launch up to 10 or even more refueling tankers, Starship tankers, to orbit in pretty quick succession over the course of a few weeks. And in order to do that, the only way to enable that is to be recovering these ships, recovering these boosters, quickly turning them around and flying them again. So each one of these steps builds to the next one.
Yeah, and to kind of, there's a lot of challenges because only so much of that fuel will survive the trip out of the gravity well of Earth into low Earth orbit, that you'll only be able to deliver so much, and then ultimately transferring that fuel and then storing it in low Earth orbit. There's a lot of challenges and boil off and so on and so forth. So there's things that need to be solved, but ultimately when those ships do get into orbit or are already in orbit, then need to be refueled. This is all new stuff. That's very cutting edge.
It is. And just think about aerial refueling in the military. The Air Force, sure, and Navy do that. And it's really comparable to that. That's pretty routine now. but it wasn't routine when they first tried it. And I think that's what we're going to be in store for over the next couple of years is these experiments. Wouldn't be surprised if something goes wrong during one of these experiments. It's never been tried by anyone before at this scale. And these propellants, you mentioned boil off, they're really cold. They're cryogenic. They're stored, you know, at temperatures hundreds of degrees below zero, liquid methane, liquid oxygen. And they have to bring the ships together. They kind of do they dock belly to belly in orbit, and then they transfer the fuel. And the you mentioned it has to burn most of that propellant just to get up there. So that's why you have to have 10 or more of these ships, these tankers, to dock with a depot, basically, and refill it little by little. And you basically replace the weight or mass or in volume of where you would carry a satellite or satellites and just put a big fuel tank there, and that's what you transfer little by little over this number of flights.
Yeah, and then beyond that, making the trip to the moon or beyond, I think it is fascinating because we're still in the early stages of it, but this is still extraordinary what's been accomplished. We've talked in the final minute or so we have, once upon a time, and it wasn't that long ago, reusing a rocket it can't be done. And now we have potentially another competitor in this space launching very soon that may get into the reusability game. So at least part of the rocket. So steps are being made, and the pace seems to be picking up, if you will, and that's exciting.
Oh, for sure, Steve. The pace is really remarkable. I remember a year, I think it was like 2011 or 2007, somewhere around there. There were seven satellite launches in total from the United States that year. And this, for SpaceX alone, they can do that in a couple of weeks now. And that is just remarkable. When I started my career in journalism, that's the trajectory that I've seen, from seven launches a year to seven launches in, let's say, 14 or 15 days. And it's all enabled by recovering and reusing rockets.
Yeah, great stuff. And we didn't even have time to get into human space flight and where that stands. We'll have to do that next time. But some big launches coming up. New Glenn and Starship scheduled to fly very soon indeed. And you can follow all that at ArsTechnica.com. Stephen Clark, always good to visit with you. Thanks.
Always good to be with you. Thank you.
And he joined us on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline here on News Talk 830-WCCO. Steve in for Henry tonight. He'll be back Friday night to close out the week. Chris Tubbs, our producer, alongside. Timberwolves on the road beat the Orlando Magic 104-89. They led it 29-18 after one.
Take that, Shaq and Penny.
Yeah. That's a way back machine.
You like that?
They extended their lead in quarter number two, extended their lead into quarter number three, and cruised to the finish line with a nice win. Listen to these numbers, points-wise anyway. Julius Randle, 23. Anthony Edwards, 21. Naz Reid, 16. Dante DiVincenzo had 12. Rudy Gobert had 10. And if my Anoka Hennepin math is correct, that's five in double figures. And the Timberwolves coast to a victory on the road against a solid Orlando team.
Yeah, I mean, but Orlando wasn't playing anybody tonight. Mo Wagner's out, Franz Wagner, Pablo Boncaro, not going to be back till tomorrow. I mean, I don't want to be the wet blanket when it comes to the Timberwolves. I mean, because... Yeah, obviously they're our favorite local basketball team that plays in downtown Minneapolis. A win is a win for a team that has still kind of yet to find its footing.
But what we have seen from this club is they would take a game like this when maybe the other club has stars out of the lineup for whatever reason. It's a weeknight game, maybe not a lot of buzz in the building. And they let the other club hang around. And if you're good enough to be in the NBA, you still have quite a bit of talent. If you're good enough to be on an NBA roster, and you're allowed to hang around. You can do damage. So I'll take this as a positive. 15-point win on the road. Take it and move on. A nice balance in this lineup. And you made a good point during the break. And that is Mike Conley to the bench, coming off the bench, and Dante DiVincenzo in the starting lineup, trying to find kind of a rotation that works for this team. Here we are, almost to the halfway point. Timberwolves have now played 37. Still kind of figuring it out, but still time.
Yeah, no question. And we've seen this two out of the last 3 years. A couple years ago, we saw the Rudy Gobert thing, and they're trying to figure out how everything's going to work. Last year, ran it back, had, a great season. But now, this year, you're kind of having deja vu of a couple years ago. I understand why they had to make the Karl-Anthony Towns trade. I totally get that, because you're in a position where you can't afford that salary. You can't. You needed to give yourself some financial flexibility.
And well, they had three max guys.
And that's just it. I mean, Julius Randle is on an expiring deal. You got Dante DiVincenzo, who is under team control for $12 million over the next 3 years. So you are in a position where you have a little bit of financial flexibility, and you don't have any picks because he traded everything for Rudy Gobert. So I understand why they had to do it. I don't like that it was done so close to the regular season, but at the same time, you have to continue to let Anthony Edwards, do his thing. But at the same time, Dante DiVincenzo, maybe this is the spark. Maybe he's got to be that guy, because Mike Conley, is that still bothering him? He's 37 years old. The guy is a consummate professional. I think Mike Conley will tell you, whatever it takes to win this game, he's all for whatever. He's the ultimate teammate. I mean, there's a reason why he was named, the best teammate in the NBA for several years in a row.
Yeah, and I think you get back to, at this point in his career, he wants to get to the NBA Finals. And if his role is better suited as being a mentor and coming off the bench and still playing meaningful minutes, and he did play meaningful minutes tonight, and is still a huge part of it. In reality, you've seen enough NBA games. You know how it goes. Starters come out, they start, you go to the bench, and people rotate in and out of the game. Other than getting the start, I'm still more in who finishes.
Exactly. Yeah, it's about who closes, not who opens.
Right. For sure. For sure. By the way, not the best news out of St. Paul, Colorado, leading the Minnesota Wild 3-1 in that one over in St. Paul.
Patrick Waugh having a hell of a night, isn't he?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
How about Peter Forsberg? What's Peter Forsberg's line look like?
Yeah, once again, to the way back machine, I love it.
I'm more than just a pretty face, TVT. I mean, you know that. I'm pretty smart when it comes to the ball.
PWHL Minnesota, they did get a win last night. I didn't get a chance to bring it up with Vanita on the morning news. I was sitting in for Henry this morning. And by the way, that's a real honor to be on the morning news. It really is.
You finally made it.
Well, yeah. And now if I fill in for Henry, Jimmy will say, hey, Henry's out of town or has a day off or whatever. Can you jump on? It's like, yeah, absolutely. So I've had a chance to not only visit with Vanita, but send some of the people she have filled in for her, which has been kind of fun in the morning, like Tom Hauser has been in.
Hauser man.
Yeah, longtime reporter at Channel 5, political reporter. And then, of course, Susie Jones. I visited with her on the morning news. Adam Carter.
He's been really fun.
Yeah, been fun. But the Frost got a win at the X last night. 2-1 in overtime. The win in goal, Matty Rooney, the hero from Andover, had a big night in goal. And then Taylor Heise, first star in the game, got the winner in overtime for the Frost, and they're back at it Sunday against Montreal. So the defending champs having a good year in second place, if memory serves, in the standings. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to put a bow on it with headlines in a moment here on News Talk. 830-WCCO. It is that time to close out the show. Steve Thompson in. Henry Lake has the night off. Chris Tubbs is here. Chris, headlines, the floor is yours.
Oh, man. I got the floor. I got the mic. I got the board. I got the phone. I got everything.
You got all the control.
I know. Well, that's a bad thing to let somebody like me in control. But here we go. A Minnesota judge has ordered MyPillow to pay nearly $778,000 for unpaid bills and other costs to package delivery DHL, which they had sued. The company that's synonymous with its founder, chief pitchman and election denier Mike Lindell. The award includes over $48,000 in interest and over $4,800 for DHL's attorney fees. The order, signed last month by Hennepin County Judge Susan Burke, said MyPillow had agreed in October to pay DHL $550,000, but failed to do so and did not send anyone to a hearing last month on DHL's effort to collect. DHL's lawsuit filed in September is one of a series of legal and financial disputes involving the Chaska, Minnesota-based MyPillow and Lindell, a prominent supporter of President-elect Donald Trump, who has helped amplify Trump's false claims that the 2020 election was stolen from him. Lindell said after the lawsuit was filed that MyPillow stopped using DHL over a year earlier in a dispute that shipments, he said, were DHL's fault. The MyPillow guy is also being sued for defamation by two voting machine companies, Dominion Voting Systems in Washington, D.C., and Smartmatic here in Minnesota.
Yeah, and you've got to wonder with the incoming administration how any of that will be impacted. The only other thing, when I hear stories about Mike Lindell and MyPillow, is do you think there's ever any regret? I always wonder that.
Yeah, I kind of...
Why did I go there, mm-hmm, kind of thing?
Yeah, you lost your business and all of these millions of dollars for nothing. You basically threw it away on a lie, and you bankrupted your business based on the fact that Donald Trump lied to you.
I just wonder about the regret. I think there's a lot of people that look back at their life or look at moments in their life and have regrets. That's human. That's a human condition. And I always think about that. You know, I think there's some people that, you know, maybe they'll throw stones in this case. I just wonder about the regret.
His life was ruined over a lie. And I feel bad in that sense because it was a great reclamation story. But damn it, dude, you did it to yourself. Like, you did this to yourself. And you're paying the
ultimate. And we haven't heard the end of the story.
No, we haven't. I mean, I'm still waiting for the evidence to come out. You know, maybe that'll be the 2028 election. Who knows?
Yeah, and like I say, there's other proceedings, and once again, there's more to the story for sure.
Yeah. Hey, Attorney General Merrick Garland told Congress he plans to make Special Counsel Jack Smith's report in the case against Donald Trump available to the committee leaders and ultimately the public once courts allow, marking the formal end of Smith's office. Garland noted he believes even the part of the report about the classified documents case should be public someday. Garland, in a letter sent Wednesday to House and Senate Judiciary Committee chairs and ranking members, outlines how he wants to confidentially provide to them Smith's volume on the classified documents case, how he wants to release to Congress, the public, the volume on Trump's 2020 election interference criminal charges. Garland specified he would do so, quote, when permitted to do so by the court. Both cases have been dismissed before any findings of guilt or innocence, and the defendants are currently challenging the release of all parts of Smith's report, signaling a major shift in the approach to transparency from the Justice Department that is expected in Trump's administration. Now, Garland also says that the letter, he never disagreed with any of Smith's proposed actions as, quote, inappropriate or unwarranted. Those types of splits between the attorney general and a special counsel are to be disclosed to Congress. But he said there were no such instances during Special Counsel Smith's investigation. I've determined that once those criminal proceedings have concluded, releasing Volume 2 of the report to you and to the public would also be in the public interest, consistent with law and department policy, he said. Now, the letter is part of the expected wrap-up action at the closure of a special counsel's office, as outlined in the Justice Department regulations. But Garland's outline differs from others, given the outgoing court action over Trump's report, which he and his co-defendants in the classified documents case are trying to keep secret in its entirety. Ruling on Garland's disclosure from a federal appeals court was expected as early as today.
I think any reasonable American citizen wants transparency. If tax dollars were spent and the information isn't classified to the point of impacting national defense or assets we have around the world, I think the public has a right to know. And that means liberals, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats. I think if we're going to get to a place where we have trust in government and how government operates, we need that transparency. We need to know what's in these reports, the good, the bad, the ugly. Mm-hmm. And once again, I don't care, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, I think the public has a right to see it. It's like Bob Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey. You know, the right decision was made. He was convicted, and we've moved on.
If you're guilty, you're guilty. It doesn't matter party affiliation.
I think we'll all be better off when we get to the rule of law applies to everyone.
Everybody, yes.
Everyone.
We can't pick and choose. All right. Yeah. And finally, Steve, we'll end on this one. Pamela Anderson has recounted how she was confronted on board a flight after being mistaken for a member of the country band The Chicks, formerly known as the Dixie Chicks. Speaking about her new movie, The Last Showgirl, she was on the Happy, Sad, Confused podcast Tuesday. She told host Josh Horowitz that she was targeted by a fellow passenger. Quote, this one time I was on a flight, and this guy came up to me and said, do you know what this country's done for you? And she was like, oh, my God, what have I done? I was like, oh, God, I look back, and he was angry. Then the stewardess had to handcuff him to the chair because he was trying to attack me. It ended up he thought I was a Dixie Chick. Now, if you remember the whole Dixie Chick thing, she said, referring to the criticism of the band and its members after they spoke out against the United States invasion of Iraq in 2003. She said, I almost got killed on that plane. I was scared to fly a little bit after that. Now, excuse me, in 2003, before the invasion of Iraq, lead singer Natalie Maine said at a concert that the group, which got its start in Dallas, did not endorse the war and were, quote, ashamed of the president of the United States. It's from Texas. Now, their remarks about then-President George W. Bush triggered boycotts and backlash from fans, resulting in country stations across the country pulling the group's music from the radio. At the time, in March 2003, it was reported that station managers said their decisions were prompted by calls from irate listeners that the criticism of the president was unpatriotic. And I got to tell you, quick
story. I remember that.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember that big time. Yeah.
I got to tell you, I was working in at Real Country 102 KRCQ in Detroit Lakes, and I was a country music DJ.
Wait a minute. Real Country.
Real Country 102 KRCQ. Chris Tubbs, nice. After Brian Domholt in the afternoon, was also the play-by-play broadcaster for the Detroit Lakes Lakers football and basketball teams. But no,
nice.
My boss, who was a diehard Republican, he's like, and we had, you know, we had network programming, and they're like, hey, we're gonna play the Dixie Chicks. He's like, you have to go, you know, cover the song. I'm like, I don't know what song, and I don't know how long, I don't know when. He's like, well, just be ready to cover it. And I'm like, I don't know what song, like, because different songs have different lengths. So I had to have like three different songs. And I swear, if there was like 2 seconds of a Dixie Chick song, he would come storming into the studio. The GM would be, whoa, how come that was there? And I'm like, we're on the bird. I don't know when they're playing it. I don't know what they're playing. And I'm sitting there for like hours at end trying to cover up a 3.5 minute Dixie Chick song.
And you're just trying to stay employed.
It was like, I don't know, 30. Yeah, it was like 2 months later, I left for Ottumwa, Iowa. Best move that I made. We'll go to 58.
Poor Pamela Anderson. All right, we got to run. We've got all the news, all the weather at 9. Chris, it's been fun. Thanks. Have a good evening.